You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And Bernie is not with us today. Normally we have brunch with Bernie as our first hour on Friday. If you've ever listened to or watched the show on a Friday, you well know. But he's in South America right now, so not available. But a question. Should Bernie run? I think he should. I'll just put my bias out right here at the very beginning. Should Bernie run in the Democratic primary, if there is a Democratic primary, or should he jumpstart one? Well, yeah, there will be a Democratic primary because the president's not up for re-election. So should Bernie run in the Democratic primary rather than as an independent for president of the United States? Shane suggested if he wins, we could start calling, you know, he would have no problem calling in every Friday. He could even be on Air Force One, right? And we could call it, Pretzels with the President or something. I mean, you know, maybe you have a good name for what we could call that first hour Friday segment if Bernie becomes president. It's been brunch with Bernie for the last 9 years, but, you know, maybe we could come up with something a little more creative. But I think that his participation in the Democratic primary would have the effect of moving, you know, first of all, I wouldn't give up any hope that he might even get nominated. There is a huge populist sentiment in the United States, and that would be an amazing thing. But even if he doesn't get nominated, his presence there would move the rest of the party, albeit incrementally, but still would move the rest of the party to the left in a more progressive direction. At least the progressive message would be presented, and it wouldn't be all third way all the time. The third way is, you know, the latest incarnation of the DLC, and most of the people who are on their board of directors are banksters, bizarrely enough, as Marcos Melitzis does such a brilliant job of pointing out over at Daily Kos. So, you know, just toss that out. In the next hour, in the second hour of our program today, Lamar Waldron and Abraham Bolden are going to be with us. Abraham Bolden, third hour. Okay, thank you, Shane. In the third hour of our program. Abraham Bolden was the first African-American Secret Service agent on the presidential detail. Jack Kennedy personally asked him to be a member of his protective detail. And Abraham Bolden tried to fly to Washington, D.C. to tell the Warren Commission that the mob tried to kill Kennedy in Chicago, which is where Bolden was stationed, 2 weeks before Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. And he was arrested the day that he was supposed to testify, or maybe it was the day before, and sent to prison for 7 years, basically to shut him up. What he didn't know was that the Johnson administration believed that at that point in time that Fidel Castro was behind the assassination, and that the Cuba attempt might have been Fidel Castro as well. And that if the American people learned about this, we would have something even worse than the Cuban Missile Crisis, and therefore this had to be covered up. This was called the Cuba Contingency Project, Cuba Contingency Plan. Al Haig helped draw it up. You can read all about it in the books that Lamar Waldron and I wrote, Ultimate Sacrifice and Legacy of Secrecy, and now Lamar has a new book out. I forget the title, but he will remind you when he comes on. And Abraham Bolden actually is the author of a book called Echo from Dealey Plaza. So in any case, that's going to be a third hour. But the rest of the day, you know, there's a lot going on. I'm just going to turn this into Anything Goes Friday and take your calls. And I see that we already have callers from Washington, California, New York, Arizona, Tennessee, Oklahoma, and Vermont on the line. And we will get to your calls in just a moment. I do want to just lay a couple of things out. That, you know, just put them in the memosphere here. I thought this was particularly humorous. This is what happens when you let Republicans introduce legislation. Republican Senator Richard J. Ross of Massachusetts has proposed a law in Massachusetts that says if you and your wife are involved in a divorce proceeding, and you go to the, quote, marital home, end quote, or she does, depending on which one of you ends up with the house or the apartment, and have sex, or conduct, quote, a dating relationship, end quote, you can go to prison. Unless, and I am quoting from the law. In fact, here's the whole thing. In divorce separation or 209A proceedings involving children and a marital home, the party remaining in the home shall not conduct a dating or sexual relationship within the home until a divorce is final and all financial and custody issues are resolved, unless the express permission is granted by the courts. Don't you love these small government Republicans? Now, I can tell you what he was trying to do. What he was trying to do, he probably had a divorce and didn't like the fact that his wife had a boyfriend during the divorce proceedings. And so he's trying to, you know, stick up for every guy who was ever in that situation or, what, you know, some kind of nonsense like that. Or he knows somebody or whatever, you know. And so what he meant was, that the woman who's divorcing, and in all probability, this, you know, the intent of this was part of the Republican war on women, that the woman who is, you know, getting divorced can't have a relationship, because this only targets the marital home and only when there are children. And, you know, 90%+ of the cases where you've got a marital home and children, the wife ends up with custody. Maybe it's not 90% anymore, but it's well over 50. So I think it's safe to say this is targeting women. And basically, what he intends to say is you can't have a boyfriend. Excuse me, sneezing here. You can't have a boyfriend until the divorce is finalized, unless the court says so. But it's written so broadly that you can't even get back together. It's bizarre. Nice story about it over at the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress. It's hysterical. I mean, this is don't let Republicans near legislation. I mean, it should be, you know, we should all just know this, right? It's a truism. Congressman Mark Pocan, by the way, with the Congressional Progressive Caucus, he represents Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. How can Wisconsin have a guy as crazy as Paul Ryan and a guy as sane as Mark Pocan, both of them representing the same state? This makes no sense to me. But in any case, yesterday was Truth in Trade Day 4. NAFTA opens U.S. roads to poorly regulated trucks from Mexico. Today, he's talking about exposing our so-called free trade is exposing us to chemistry that we would not allow in this country. And he's right. So, a lot of great stuff going on. And Paul Ryan is not backing down from his it's lazy inner city men who are responsible for poverty comments, although somebody did confront him about it yesterday and said, in fact, an African-American guy, black guy, challenged him and said, you know, why are you making comments about us, basically? And Paul Ryan was like, whoa, wait a minute, I never mentioned race. No, you just said inner-city men and culture and multi-generation, no work ethic. These are the buzzwords that Reagan was tossing out at the suggestion of Lee Atwater. You can read Lee Atwater's, if you can even listen to it, Lee Atwater's famous interview back in 1981, where he said the N-word a few times, and he says, you know, we don't say that anymore. And back in the 60s and 70s with Nixon, we talked about forced busing. I mean, that was, you know, but we don't even need to do that anymore. All we need to do now is say tax cuts. And everybody gets it that we're talking about cutting off the welfare to those minorities. Paul Ryan is continuing the tradition.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We don't need those stinking N-words. We got plenty of dog whistles. That's basically the Republican strategy. And welcome back. We got a bunch of calls about Bernie. And that's an interesting one too. Susan in Knoxville, Tennessee, you wanted to talk about what's going on in Uganda with gay folks.
Yes, and I have a suggestion. I really mean it quite seriously. Mm-hmm. If certain people, in this particular case, LGBT people, are oppressed and their lives are actually threatened, I think that Americans who care should encourage them to seek asylum in the United States, especially since Americans had so much to do with that coming down upon them. And I think that, I mean that quite seriously.
Right. That makes perfect sense. And the, you know, the, right now the Obama administration is, John Kerry has opened contacts with his peer in the Ugandan, government. And in fact, President Museveni has even said, and Rachel Maddow reported this on her show a couple days ago, Museveni has said that he's willing to reconsider this law, but he, you know, he wants something. You know, he'd like a little more foreign aid from the United States or something. Who knows?
Well, something. But I.
Yeah.
The risk is, you know, the risk is still there. And.
But if the Obama administration was to just come right out and say we are publishing officially, because they create the guidelines, this doesn't require an act of Congress. I'm pretty sure that who is an oppressed person at risk of persecution that qualifies under our what was the word you used?
Yes.
Yeah. What was the word that you used? Not amnesty. Asylum. That qualifies under our asylum laws. That list of people is compiled, I believe, by the administration. And if that's the case, President Obama could put gay Ugandans on that list tomorrow morning and just open the door. And that would be an amazing thing. I mean, you know, talk about putting some pressure, not just on Uganda, but making a statement that will be heard all over the world.
Exactly, especially since Americans and officials from America had so much to do with causing their oppression. And wouldn't that just turn around and bite those wonderful conservatives right where it hurts?
Yeah. Well, and you look at these guys like Tom Coburn and Jim DeMint and, you know, these guys who live at the on E Street, on the house that's owned by the family. Is it E Street or C Street? It's one of those streets. They own this townhouse. And it's run as a church, so they get very, very cheap rent. And you know, and this is the group that sponsors the annual prayer breakfast that presidents go to, bizarrely enough. And they keep sending people over to Uganda to tell them how to, you know, kill the gay people or to imprison the gay people.
Exactly.
And you know, somebody needs to be calling them out. Jeff Charlotte wrote this brilliant book. We had Jeff on this program a bunch of times. I think, frankly, it's time for us to get him back. And Sean, if you happen to be listening, lest I forget, let's see if we can get Jeff Charlotte on to talk about the family and the whole Uganda situation. But, you know, somebody needs to call him out, and this would be a great way to do it. Great idea, Susan. Thank you for the call. And thank you for watching Free Speech TV, which is doing its fundraising drive right now, by the way, and this is a really urgent time. A really urgent time. I mean, they're at the point where they may have to start cutting staff or cutting back on programming if they can't hit their budget for this, you know, for the end of May, which is the money they're raising right now. So call them. A little bit of geeky science news, too, I want to get into as we go on through the day. I'll come back to this, but just an amazing discovery that they've made in the outer reaches of our atmosphere that radically increases the probability that there's intelligent life throughout the universe. It's an amazing, amazing thing. I'll tell you about that probably in the next hour. Sharon in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Sharon, what's up?
Hi. First, I have a big favor to ask you. You're not on live here anymore because of an hour show that shoves you back. So can you please leave me on the phone until you totally answer it, or I won't hear the answer until I download my podcast.
Sure.
Anyway, the question I have is, I would love to see somebody like Bernie run, or Elizabeth Warren, or, you know, whatever. My question is that the way Congress, the Senate, and the House are right now, even if the Senate stays Democratic and all of that, how is somebody with their kind of ethics and ideas going to get anything done with the way our government runs now? I mean, look at what they've done to Barack Obama.
Yeah. It's a good question. If I think the simple answer is that if America were to elect Bernie Sanders as president, or if he was just, even if the Democratic Party was to nominate him as the presidential standard bearer, he is such a populist that, and he so adequately speaks to people's fundamental needs. I mean, Louise and I lived in Vermont for almost 10 years. We lived 4 or 5 years in Northfield and 4 or 5 years in Montpelier. And we used to drive, and this was, you know, we'd lived there for a while, in fact, probably 4 or 5 years before I ever met Bernie, before I knew Bernie. I mean, I'd been to a couple of his events. You know, he'd be having an event in town. I didn't even know it was a Bernie fundraiser. It's just like, hey, they've got music going down at the ball field. Let's walk over. And there's a Bernie fundraiser, you know. If you drove, I remember the 2004 election. We lived in Vermont during the 2000 election and the 2004 election. And in both those elections, we would, in the fall, drive up through what's called the Northeast Kingdom. It's the northeastern third of Vermont, and it's very rural, it's very poor, and it's very red. It is the Republican part of Vermont. And there would be signs, yard signs. There was always a George Bush sign, and there was always a Bernie Sanders sign. And these Republicans who loved George Bush still supported Bernie because they knew he told the truth. And so I think that if Bernie were to win the White House, and we were having pretzels with the president every Friday rather than brunch with Bernie, if he were to win the White House, he would bring with him such a landslide of other progressive candidates, because other people would figure out, this is how you run, this is how you win, this is how you win even in Republican districts. You keep your message economic and populist, economic and populist. And that's what Bernie has done. I mean, you can ask him just about anything, and eventually he's going to bring it back around to, you know, economic populism. Either our government is working for working people or it's working against working people. And you know, in almost any context. And so there I think you'd have those coattails. Sharon, thank you for the call. That's my comment. Diana in Canoga Park, California. Hey, Diana. You think
it's
Bernie can...
Burr Hills, California.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
That's all right. Lots of Republicans here, and it's mostly a retirement-ish type community, but I'm still working. I'm 60 years old, lifelong Democrat. I think what you just said about Bernie is brilliant. You give us a great education, especially out here in California, where we don't see what happens on the East Coast on a day-to-day type basis. But I did want to mention that from my point of view, and also from the sort of moderate point of view out here, even though I happen to be very progressive, the majority of people out here in this location are moderate, with some, you know, progressive ideas, especially social progressive ideas. But I agree with you about the tremendous value of having Bernie in the primaries and getting progressives excited.
Yes.
Forget about mainstream Democrats. You've got to get the progressives excited because based on the previous elections where we thought we'd get change with President Obama, I can't even face my progressive friends anymore because all I ever hear, which is sort of mutually reinforcing depression, about how disappointed we are on so many levels. And we can't keep blaming the Republicans. It's the mainstream Democrats that have top to bottom.
Well, it's
just
a little bit of all of it. But, you know, let's be honest.
If
the Supreme Court had not allowed billionaires to insert themselves into our political process, in fact, encouraged them to, we would not have the situation we have right now. You would not. There would not be a Tea Party because they invented the Tea Party.
Yeah, Hillary Clinton, I'm sorry. The Clintons are creatures of Wall Street. I refuse to vote for Hillary Clinton. And if that means I vote for some third party and my vote doesn't matter in any significant way, so be it. But I just refuse to do it any longer. And I think so many of us, and I'm a 60-year-old Democrat, lifelong Democrat.
Yeah.
We're disgusted, Tom. We're absolutely disgusted.
If you look at Hillary's career, the one thing that she has been very successful at is basically reinventing herself. And I'm just constantly reminded of the biography of FDR that I read about 8 years ago, That, you know, he was this upper middle class, relatively conservative, very wealthy family, ran New York State as the governor of New York, arguably the most corrupt state in the country at the time. Maybe New Jersey was number one, New York was number two. You had a giant machine running out of Manhattan. He didn't try to break any of that up. He didn't, you know, he was not a progressive when he ran the state of New York. And he became president, and the people demanded a progressive, and he became a progressive. I don't subscribe to the great man theory of history. I don't believe that we have to pick the perfect candidate. I think we have to create the perfect movement. And if there's enough of us out there demanding a progressive, and Hillary Clinton becomes the nominee, she will become a progressive. If there's enough of us, the parade has to get big enough. Diana, respectfully, thank you very much for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And this is absolutely not blame the victim stuff. This is how politics actually works. The bigger the, whatever parade is the biggest, that's the one the politicians are going to follow. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, helping you in the water cooler wars. Today our Anything Goes Friday. By the way, tonight on the Tevelvision, I will be interviewing a half-hour interview with Lawrence Wilkerson. I'm really looking forward to this. The right-hand man of Colin Powell when he was Secretary of Defense during the war, right? Or no, he was Secretary of State. Yeah, Secretary of State. And you know, he had Thomas Jefferson's old job. And, you know, which is pretty amazing when you think about it, and on a whole bunch of levels. And I am really looking forward to having a conversation with him. I think it should be fascinating. That'll be tonight at 7 o'clock Eastern time. Matthew in Cazenovia, New York. Hey, Matthew, what's up?
How you doing, Tom? I've been trying to convince people that, in my opinion, profit is just the modern word for corporate theft, okay? And I'd like to give you a quick explanation. I'm a house painter, mm-hmm. and if I paint a 10-by-10 wall, the value I create is $65, okay?
Wait a minute. You mean the amount of money that you charge would be $65. The value you create could be substantially more than that.
This is for the sake of an explanation.
Okay.
Okay. Some people charge 85 cents a square foot. That'd give you, you know, $85, whatever.
Right.
The point is still the same. That's the value created. The value created doesn't change. If I want to turn a profit on that 10-by-10 wall, I either have to pay my employees much less than that $65, or I have to charge my customer more than that $65. Either way, the value that was created by painting that wall is still $65. So in my opinion, I see them Republicans saying I should have the right to turn a profit, basically as saying I should have the right to rip you off. Because if everybody gets their paycheck at the end of the week and no extra money is generated by that company, everyone made out okay, and most likely everyone got paid more. And I think I think not-for-profit is extremely important in banks, energy, food, education, and defense. And if those industries were all turned to not-for-profit, because you know how the Republicans are always saying, private industry can do it better. Well, that's the answer to that. Okay, private industry can do it better. As long as they're doing it not-for-profit, nobody gets screwed, and let the private industries run it.
Yeah.
I think if we could get that message out better to people, they might understand what's going on a little better.
Right.
I think that, you know, it's
well, and you make a reasonable point. Number one, Switzerland is probably most famous for this. Most of the developed countries of the world do not allow for-profit health insurance, or if they do, you can't do it for primary health insurance. You can only do it for secondary health insurance that would cover things like, you know, catered meals to your, you know, suite or something like that in the hospital. But, you know, they're very clear about this. But the other thing is that most small businesses in America, 97% of all corporations that file income tax returns in the United States, which would include this show, don't show a profit. Therefore, they don't pay income taxes. And, you know, to the best of my knowledge, we don't show a profit at the end of every year. Because basically what they do is, you know, you work out your budgets throughout the year. You pay your employees whatever you can pay them. You pay your expenses, and if at the end of the year you got some money left over, and then typically a small business will invest that money. You know, we've over the years we've gone from a little tiny, you know, two pieces of equipment in my living room to a big studio here with, you know, $100,000 worth of stuff and racks and whatnot and fancy boards. And I would just love to update our audio board to a digital board. We haven't made enough money to do that yet, but you know, we've constantly put money back into this business. In fact, the first 3-4 years, Louise and I didn't even take a paycheck out of it. And because we just keep plowing it back in. And I'm guessing with your painting business, you probably do something very much like that. So functionally, most small businesses are run as nonprofits anyway.
Yeah, I just meant that's a great, I think, answer to when they say, well, we need to privatize it because a private company will run it better.
Yeah.
Then why don't we just go along with them and say, okay, fine, but it has to be not for profit so that it's good for everyone.
I see your...
They'll get their paychecks.
I see your nonprofit and I raise it. ESOPs.
Not nonprofit, not for profit.
Yeah, not for profit. Let me raise it to an ESOP. I'm not sure that this kind of business, you know, where it's basically, you know, my program that we're selling. But if you had a company that could survive the death of its founder, a company that was manufacturing something or retailing something, and you know, I think the best model for those, and we've done this now with two companies where we built them up and we sold them to our employees and then we left. Actually, with three companies. One of them, my employees crashed the company fairly quickly. It took about a year. But another one, the employees turned it into a $250 million a year, or not a year, total revenue business, you know, which I saw nothing of. But, you know, good on them. And so employee stock option programs or converting, you know, businesses into basically, you know, employee run, what would you call it? Cooperatives. I think that that's a great way to do it too. But to your point, Matthew, brilliant. Thank you for the call. Steve in Phoenix. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Just I'd like to make a couple quick, comments here before I talk about Bernie. The thing, you forgot in Wisconsin, it's actually 3-1. The crazies are ahead. And we forgot about a guy from Milwaukee and a guy from Kenosha, and that would be Scott Walker and Rance Priebus.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
It's
got to be something in the water, you know?
Oh, there's something there. The other thing for Bernie, we could call it on Fridays if he's in Air Force One, you'd call it Flying High Fridays.
There you go. Okay. Let the names begin. The alliterations begin.
Yeah.
Flying High Fridays. Okay.
Okay.
We got to come up with a list, and next week when Bernie comes on, we'll read the list to him. So if any of you have suggestions.
Yeah,
your thoughts on Bernie.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, before your program came on, I was just checking the market over on CNBC, and this is one of the reasons why I want to say for Bernie here. It kind of made me sick. They were showing this a piece on a $13 million estate in Frisco, and It's they've got a new acronym for these people called YUMMY. It's young urban male, and they spend a lot of money and they spend a lot on retail, and they're getting married later and everything. And this excess has just got to stop. And you know, it's basically due to the Reagan tax cut.
Right. You've got yuppies on steroids now.
They yeah.
Call them yummies.
Well, here, yes.
And they're probably actually literally on steroids.
You betcha. We got to get Bernie in there because he wants to get the step tax back. He wants to get back Glass-Steagall.
Right.
And, you know, I'm concerned about the money I do have in the market. I don't want Wall Street crashing it again and losing, you know, everything I've got.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's going to bring some sanity to this world. And all of his ideas are really, they're home runs for everything across the board.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, I had an epiphany today. An uncle of Louise's died a couple of weeks ago, and he had some retirement savings, and he divided it up among his to his sister, my Louise's mom, and her two children, Louise and her brother. And so Louise inherited some money, and we had to go over I shouldn't name it on the air, but it was, you know, one of these brokerage houses today, and sign some paperwork. And it's just a couple $1,000s, but, you know, we had to go over and sign the paperwork and basically roll it into an IRA. And I'm in this place, and I'm looking around, and there's, like, people who make a living telling people how to invest their money. And it just hit me. You know, when my dad was planning for retirement, he knew exactly how many dollars. I mean, for the last 20 years of his life, when he was still working, he knew that when he retired, he was going to have blank. You know, he was going to have $840 a month in Social Security, and he was going to have $953 a month in pension, and he was going to have his health insurance paid for. He knew, because he had a good union job, and he knew what his retirement was going to be. And he didn't have to play the market. And now, you know, Reagan changed the rules in the 80s, and so that, you know, we all basically got thrown into the stock market along with rich people, so we'd all start thinking like rich people. I mean, that was the mentality, right? Get people liking the stock market, and now I've got to become an investment advisor, you know, for my own money, whatever that may be. You know, it's like whether you've got $5,000 or $10,000 or $50,000 or $100,000, whatever it may be, whatever your retirement is, suddenly you're out there competing with the Wall Street billionaires to figure out how to make sure that your money doesn't get wiped out. And a lot of people got their money wiped out in the crash of 2008. And you know, trying to hit that, you know, at least keeping up with inflation. And it's like, this is nuts. I would be, you know, I think most Americans would be real happy if we had never abandoned pensions. So you could just know when you hit 65, you're going to be able to retire at this level of income. And my dad would still have been able to buy a new car every 2 years, and his house would have been paid. It was paid off when he retired. And he had enough money that him and my mom could travel around the country in a mobile home and visit antique stores and shows, which was their goal. They had saved up, you know, thousands of dollars worth of antiques that they were going to go out and sell on the road for extra money. And that was his retirement plan. I mean, he didn't live long enough to see it, but, you know, because he worked in a factory where he was exposed to asbestos when mom was pregnant with me, and the asbestos killed him, but mesothelioma. But that was, you know, and it's like, this is nuts that anyhow, I went off on a rant, Steve.
I agree. You know, and most people are they're very ill-equipped to manage their own 401s. They don't know anything about stock.
Well, I can tell you, I don't know anything about it. I mean, I made a couple $100s last year. It's like, it's not even keeping, whatever it was. I mentioned it on the air a couple months ago, and I finally figured it out. And in fact, the year before that, I think I lost money. It's like, how do you do this? I'm a talk show host, not an investment advisor. Steve, thank you for the call. And I don't think most people want to be professional money managers. And who wants to pay somebody to do it?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Anyhow, enough of that rant. We do need, though, I really think we need to bring back pensions. 15 minutes before. Welcome back. Philip in Bristol, Vermont. Hey, Philip, thanks for watching Free Speech TV, which, by the way, is in their fundraising drive. Give them a call at 877-378-8669. Philip, what's up?
Tom Hartman, it's the longest wait I've ever had in my lifetime when I always call you, but I'm calling you to tell you I want to endorse Bernie for president.
Great.
I want to stop the coronation of Hillary Clinton. And you know it, Tom, and everybody in America knows it. We're calling it here in Vermont the coronation of Hillary Clinton.
Well, there's an upside and a downside to this. The downside is that she, being the presumptive nominee, is arguably keeping people out of the primary race right now. You know, there's not a lot of people saying, well, maybe I'll run for president. I mean, Bernie is, but that's so far. I mean, Elizabeth Warren hasn't said anything, although she's being coy. So in a way, Hillary's keeping people out. But the flip side of that is that the Republicans are spending all their time and money right now throwing darts at Hillary. They're all, you know, they're throwing their rhetorical bullets at Hillary. They're throwing their ads at Hillary. They're writing nasty books about Hillary. They're doing everything they can. And so they are not trying to take down Elizabeth Warren. So in a way, she's acting like a human shield. So, you know, it's a mixed blessing, if I may. Back to you, Phil.
Well, like we say here in Vermont, you know, if you want a truthful person, you got to listen to what they really say.
Right.
And I really do believe that we got a Clinton doublespeak going on. And I've had my years with Mr. Clinton and Mrs. Clinton. I've had my years with her as Secretary of State. I'm ready for a leader in America, and America is calling for a leader. And when I'm tired of the Democrats telling us who we should vote for, I'm tired of the Republicans, and I'm tired of the national media telling us who we should vote for. It is time for America to start using their brains and to think about who should we elect that talk to the issues of America, not the propaganda of America. And here, I just want to use this, and then I'm going to close out. This is what I come to. We're already talking about throwing some bombs over at Russia. We don't know what's really going on over there. Let's get somebody that's got some mentality to talk. This is where we go in America. We try to talk before we reach the nuclear button and push people to hysteria.
Yeah, and I would like a president. And I would like a president who would say, you know, before we talk about having war with another country, we should talk about having war on poverty in the United States. We should, you know, we should not have ghettos in this country. We should not have underperforming schools. We should not have people living in poverty. We should not have these problems. I'm with you. Detroit Johnny O in Romulus, Michigan. We got a minute till the break. It's yours.
Tom, yes. Senator Bernie Sanders should be nominated for the candidacy of the presidency in the Democratic Party, along with Elizabeth Warren as his vice president. Mike Papantonio as his attorney general.
Oh, yeah.
The cabinet.
That would be a ticket. Wouldn't that be a kick-ass ticket? That would be great. And don't discount Bernie. I mean, when he was running for the House of Representatives, people said, oh, come on, he's the socialist mayor. I mean, literally, the socialist mayor of Burlington, Vermont. He's going to be a representative. Independent. Come on. And he's the longest serving independent in the history of the House of Representatives. Then he said, I'm going to run for the Senate. And everybody said, what? A senator? Are you kidding? You're outside the mainstream. You can't run for the Senate. And he's the senator. And then they said, can he get reelected? He got reelected. Bernie's a serious guy, and he says things that people actually listen to. So I'm with you, Detroit Johnny O. I'm with you. And Papantonio would make one heck of a great AG. Thanks a lot. So Bernie for president, Elizabeth Warren for vice president, and Mike Papantonio for attorney general. That was Detroit Johnny O's suggestion. I think that's a good one. Chris in Ayer, Massachusetts. Hey, Chris.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
I'm calling because I know that you're probably not going to agree with me on this because I know how responsible you are in your epistemology and your language. But I really feel like part of what I'm worried about is that with NASA's report this week that, you know, they announced officially, as it was in The Guardian, that, industrialized civilization is heading towards an irreversible collapse that's rather imminent. And attributed a lot of it to elitists not distributing resources in an equitable fashion.
Right.
And so, I'm very concerned that with the suppression of left media, with the suppression of labor, you know, you don't hear anything about the better off budget on the mainstream media. You know, the mainstream media still refuses to cover the TPP. You know, the list goes on and on,
and
I'm really worried that our movement isn't going to gain the traction it needs in time to prevent a lot of suffering. And the only thing I wanted to add was, and I think that what that requires is for us to be a bit more aggressive in terms of putting an intellectual outlier out there in terms of action. You know, things that talk about, you know, putting the jailing the people who are on Wall Street needs to become more conversational because there's 2 million of us in jail, and that doesn't seem to bother them at all. We need to be able to borrow some of the fire and brimstone that we generally see from the right to yield it on the left to make the people in the elitist, you know, corporation, you know, stratosphere, or that whole, you know, section of society, that class, right? You know, they have to begin to pay attention to the power of the people, because if not, I think that civil unrest is more likely than change in time to avert disaster.
I completely agree with you. And that's why I'm going to be signing a letter that Tim Carpenter and Progressive Democrats of America are going to send out next week, encouraging people to sign this petition over at pdamerica.org that is going to be delivered to Bernie Sanders and to Senator Sanders that says, please run in the Democratic primary for president of the United States, and I will support you. And I totally agree with everything you just said, Chris. I'm apparently not as temperate as you thought.
How about this? I'm glad to be wrong and flattered we think alike.
Okay, there you go. Thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. Lisa, listening to KVOT in Taos, New Mexico. Hey, Lisa.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say that it is such an honor to be able to speak to you, and I turn the radio on every day to listen to you to get an education.
Thank you. Be sure to thank KVOT for carrying our show and their advertisers.
Absolutely. I listen to them all day long. I wanted to say something about Paul Ryan's comment about the inner city issue.
Yes.
I taught in what would be considered an inner city school in Austin, Texas for a number of years. And when he makes comments like that, it's very insulting to the great number of beautiful and wonderful families that, by no fault of their own, are living in these inner city neighborhoods. I taught students whose parents were extremely concerned about their education, about making a better life for their children than they have for themselves. A lot of times it comes across as looking as neglect because most of those parents are out working two or three jobs just to try to make ends meet. And when he uses the term inner city and then pretends to say that he wasn't referring to blacks or even Hispanics that live in inner cities, it's extremely insulting to the intelligence, particularly as a Hispanic woman who has grown up with those kind of veiled racist comments.
He's either denying his own racism or he's making the insane argument that because he made the comment, I live in the inner city in Washington, D.C. Well, I live in Washington, D.C., too. And I can tell you, you know, downtown D.C., large parts of it are being gentrified. And you can't get an apartment for under $3,000 a month, a one-bedroom apartment. And they're all full of, you know, 20-something and 30-something people who work in the lobbying firms, the 30,000 lobbying firms in this town. And they're making $200,000 a year. And if those are the people that he was describing when he said we have a culture, multi-generational, you know, no work ethic, lazy, whatever, I just don't buy it. I don't buy it that that's what he was talking about.
Correct. Well, and that's what's happening in Austin is because I taught on the east side and I was just there recently, and to see the amount of growth that has taken place on the east side of I-35 in Austin, where it has been regentrified, and they're pushing those people out because they no longer can afford to live in those neighborhoods.
Yep.
But I had some of the smartest children I have ever taught in those inner city schools, and all they need is that hand up, and most of the parents that I worked with were too proud to take a hand out. They wanted a hand up, and it just, it really disheartens me, and it makes me really sad to think that there are people like that who believe what they say, and then when they try to backtrack and say that they were inarticulate, then he doesn't understand what the definition of inarticulate is because he perfectly made himself understood by what he was saying.
He is playing the old Reagan playbook, which is Joe Madison says it's not Jim Crow, it's James S. Crow, ESQ, right? And it, you know, as Lee Atwater said in 1981, after he had run the Reagan campaign, he said, you know, we used to use the N word, and he actually used the N word when he said it at the time. So we used to use that, Republicans, and then we started yelling about forced busing and things, and you know, we were still talking about race, but now we can talk about economics, about tax cuts, and people understand that what we're really talking about is defunding welfare to minorities. And so you get all these people who will vote for Republicans thinking that the Republican tax cuts are going to defund welfare to the minorities. And instead what happens, now this isn't what Atwater said, but, you know, I mean, Atwater said everything up to that point. But here's what happens is that, you know, we get the tax cuts like we did with Reagan. In the 80s, just as a result of Reagan's tax cuts, over $1 trillion, $1,000 billion, $1 million went to the top 1% out of the pockets of working class people in the United States. It was the largest transfer of wealth in the history of the United States. And working people voted for that because they thought they were defunding minorities in the inner cities. And Paul Ryan is still playing that. He's still playing that game. He's still using that language. And it's not just Paul Ryan. It's basically the entire Republican Party. Lisa, thank you for the call. Thanks for listening to KVOT. It's Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program, and we'll be back with more of your calls in just a few minutes. And, oh, one of the things that I just want to put on the table is your thoughts on Bernie Sanders running in the Democratic primary. You can sign the petition over pdamerica.org.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
This is hysterical. The CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, CBC.ca, as in CBC in Canada, .ca is the national, you know, Canada, right? An article by Neil MacDonald. The new GOP attack line blames world's woes on, quote, weakened America, end quote. Obama's critics are shifting from attacking Obamacare to world crises to take on the president. He says it didn't take long for America's cable rating carnival to cheapen and exploit the dread of the missing Malaysian plane, then drag it into the country's partisan wars. And he talks about how CNN is hysterical about this. And over at Fox News, it might even be terrorism. John Bolton, it's the perfect haven for terrorism. Greta Van Susteren airing dire tweets from viewers. Sean Hannity telling his sources the plane is in Pakistan. It was General Tom McKierney telling Sean Hannity, if the Pakistan government doesn't talk soon, they're going to be complicit in this. And then Neil MacDonald at the CBC says, you can see where this is going. It's Barack Obama's fault. The only reason terrorists would be so brazen is that they knew Obama wouldn't have the guts to punish them. And then he goes on about it. John McCain is out, you know, thundering about it, and Ted Cruz, and even mild-mannered Mitt Romney, freshly rehabilitated by a flattering Netflix documentary about his failed runs for the White House. Right. The GOP hymn book, Neil MacDonald says for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, if that sounds a bit rich, given the world's poor regard for Washington's leadership under George W. Bush, well, politics has little room for irony. Romney is singing straight from the new GOP hymn book. Why did Putin invade and annex Crimea, ask Republicans? Because he knew Obama wouldn't do anything. Why is Bashar al-Assad winning Syria's civil war? Because Obama didn't have the nerve to rein him in. The ongoing negotiations with Iran over its nuclear program? A shameful farce orchestrated by the cowardly Obama. Why is Afghanistan's Hamid Karzai refusing to sign the security agreement? Clearly, he doesn't trust weak-kneed Obama. And it goes on through this whole thing. And this actually is the Republican playbook. Former Vice President Dick Cheney says flatly that Obama's weakness encouraged Putin. It's incredible. Even the CBC has figured out what is going on. And then they end up, he wraps it up by saying, but suggesting that Obama is a nervous weakling is foolishness. This is a president who greatly intensified the previous administration's secret foreign warfare and the man who ordered Osama bin Laden's assassination in Pakistan. To explain his reluctance to aggressively confront entire foreign regimes, Americans should probably look first to themselves. And he's right. Americans don't want another war. We had enough with George Bush. You know, it's like we had enough crazy wars already. No more. Thank you. We've got to pay off. I mean, we got, you know, $6-8 trillion we've got to pay off from the first two over the next 20 or 30 years as these veterans age through the system. It's incredible. Ken in Silver City, New Mexico, listening on KABQ. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I love with all what you do and as far as the Democratic and progressive movement. But I just can't agree with the statement you made before with Washington, as far as saying that what happens on the parade and whatever goes on in Washington, people jump on the parade. Hillary Clinton, I don't want a flip flopper in office as far as going one way or another. And if jumping by on the parade would mean also that Bernie would change from a progressive populist to a corporate Democrat if the parade took that direction. But I wouldn't.
Bernie's not going
to. I would trust Bernie that he wouldn't do that, and I wouldn't want a president that would do that.
But see, that's the thing. Bernie has the parade. It's not that Bernie's leading a parade. It's that there's a group of people out there who are genuine progressives, and Bernie speaks to them. And by the way, that includes a lot of Republicans in the state of Vermont. He wins overwhelmingly in the state of Vermont because of what he says, because he really is a progressive. And that's my point. I mean, keep in mind, when I said that about Hillary Clinton, there was a huge caveat. And that was, if there's enough of a progressive movement in the United States, she will have no choice but to follow it, just like Franklin Roosevelt had no choice but to follow it in 1933.
You think that she would change on all issues or just flip on certain issues that's beneficial to her?
I think it would depend on the parade. It would depend on how many of us are out there and what we're yelling about. But, you know, that's frankly how it's supposed to work. We are, the whole point of representative elective government is you elect people who are going to represent your concerns and interests. And if they don't, you unelect them or you don't elect them in the first place. And so if she starts running on a platform of I'm going to protect Wall Street, I don't think she can get elected.
Well, I hope that's the case here, but that's the problem that I think that most of us have as far as not showing up at the polls. We have a choice of the corporate Democrats or the Republicans, and most of the time the statements are, which would you rather have? The corporate Democrats.
That's why showing up at the polls.
I'd rather have neither.
That's why showing up at the polls is the last thing you should do, not the first. Showing up at the polls should be what you do after you have spent 2 years in the progressive movement out there, you know, whether it's just at home sending emails and making phone calls or whether it's out knocking on doors or whatever it may be. And with whatever organization, I think movetoamend.org, for example, is doing great work. They're mobilizing people, Progressive Democrats of America. They got no affiliation with the Democratic Party whatsoever. In fact, you know, I'm sure from Chuck Schumer's point of view, they're a thorn in his side, but Mary Landrieu's point of view. But I doubt Chuck Schumer, actually. He can be progressive when he needs to be. But the fact of the matter is that it's these kinds of organizations, the MoveOn.orgs, the progressive organizations that push Democrats, and because they're constituting the parade, and that's what we need to do. Anytime anybody complains that, you know, we don't have good candidates, we have to look at ourselves. We have to say, you know, how did we not get good candidates in there? Because you can show up at the Democratic Party and or any other party you want, Republican Party, Green Party, fill in the blank. You can show up and you can run for precinct committee person and you can be the person who writes the platform for the party and you can be the person who selects who gets to run in the primaries. And this is what the Tea Partiers did with the Republican Party, and they showed up in large enough numbers that in many congressional districts, in well over 60 congressional districts across the United States, the only Republicans in the primary were all Tea Partiers. So it didn't matter which one won. It was going to be a Tea Party candidate, and it could just as easily be in the Democratic Party. Every candidate is a progressive if enough of us show up. We've got to get active. Ken, thank you for the call. I understand your concern, and I absolutely share it. And we're not helped by the Supreme Court and Citizens United and all that kind of stuff. But still, that shouldn't stop us. Rudy in Los Angeles. Hey, Rudy, what's up?
Well, Brother Tom, couple of things. Question. I'm an early retired UAW member, come out of organized labor, worked at the County Federation of Labor for 10 years. Every time when we finished a NAFTA campaign, and I was part of that here in L.A., there was talk about starting a labor party in this country, and people attended meetings. I did, but it fizzled out. How do we start a labor party here in California?
I think instead of starting another political party, we need to take over one of the ones that already exists. These are nonprofit organizations that anybody can join. Democratic Party, the Republican Party, anybody can join. Anybody can show up. And if enough people show up, they tip the balance. The Tea Partiers, the hard right, in my mind, crazies, but hey, they did it. The hard right has taken over the Republican Party to the point that they have senators like Ted Cruz. I mean, they're even moving senators. They're moving Lindsey Graham, who used to be kind of a moderate, into the neocon crazy Tea Party category. And we should be doing the same thing with the Democratic Party. It's a billion-dollar machine that we can take over if enough of us show up. That's, in my opinion, that's what we need to be doing, Rudy, rather than putting all the time and effort and mind-boggling amounts of money into creating a new party. Thank you for the call. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Anything Goes Friday. Your calls, my opinions, the news of the day. Together we'll fix the world. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ed in Belfair, Washington. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hey, Bernie. I heard Bernie. I wish I was talking to Bernie. Yes, Senator Sanders should run for president, and he should run underneath of the Democratic Party. But my topic is basically on immigration. The Republican House doesn't want to bring it up and have it voted on. In essence, not give work visas to people that have already been here for years, that know the laws, that know what needs to be done. Instead, the TPP wants to come in, written by corporations, without the Senate, without the House, without the president involved, write new laws. In essence, they have their own laws, so they can go ahead, Walmart, McDonald's, can bring in 1,000 workers from overseas. They'll be under the TPP. They may make 30 cents an hour.
Yeah, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, what you're referring to, what I refer to as the Southern Hemisphere Asia Free Trade Agreement, SHAFTA, the SHAFTA, you know, following on the heels of NAFTA and CAFTA. And I'm with you. I'm totally with you. And I predict that there's going to be a really serious and perhaps successful effort after the elections in November and before January 1st, before the new Congress, before the reboot, in the lame duck session this winter, this coming winter, there is going to be an effort under the radar, probably, you know, the week before Christmas when everybody is talking about Santa Claus and whatever. There's going to be an effort to pass this this fast-track thing so that they can put SHAFTA on steroids and shove it through with a simple up or down vote and no amendments. And it's an unconstitutional, unprincipled, undemocratic, un-American. And, you know, we just now saw, I went off on this on Monday, I think, of this week, the numbers are back 2 years since the Korea Free Trade Agreement, CAFTA, and the Korea Free Trade Agreement now has cost us at least 39,000 jobs in the United States in 2 years. And, you know, we should be able to look at this and, you know, I think the average person knows this, Ed. Back to you.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah,
I appreciate your time.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks a lot for the call, Ed. I think the people have this figured out. They know that we're being screwed and they don't like it and they don't want it. And, you know, enough of it already. Larry in Jamaica, New York. Hey, Larry.
Hey, how are you, Tom? I'm on it.
I'm fine. We just have a minute to the break. You want to talk about JFK and secret societies?
Yeah, I was hoping I would get a little more than a minute. Maybe I could wait. You could pick somebody else.
No, I'm sorry. You can call back on Monday and we can pick the topic up again.
No, nah, that's
but we've
all
just
right.
burned through a third of that minute.
Do
you want to make a point?
Yeah. No, I wanted to talk about the $43 trillion lawsuit here in South Jamaica, Queens.
Okay. Against whom? For what?
The Spire Law Group against all the major banks, the U.S. government.
Oh, interesting. If
yes.
Is there a website for this?
Yeah, there are several, and there's good information out there from places like freedomschool.com, Family Guardian, concerning a lot of the stuff that's going on, and it really reveals a lot as far as the Rothschilds, the Rosicrucians, and the whole Overlaw.
Yeah, back to the secret societies. Okay. Larry, I'll have to check it out. I didn't know about the lawsuit. Thank you for the call, and look forward to a longer conversation next week. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Randall in Skokie, Illinois. Hey, Randall, you wanted to disagree about ESOPs?
Yes, I did, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just came out of a restaurant in Evanston, Illinois, that what they do is they rehab the formerly incarcerated,
mm-hmm.
And so that got me thinking about running prisons as ESOPs. And the person you were talking about was liking doing government as nonprofits.
Well, no, he was suggesting that certain sectors of our economy could be run privately, that is, not by government, but they would have to be run on a nonprofit basis. Banking, for example, healthcare, another example. I don't remember the other ones that he mentioned. Education, I think there was like five or six that he named, and I immediately agreed with a couple of them, and I don't remember all the rest of them. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but one of the things that drives me nuts is these for-profit prisons.
Yeah.
And I understand that, you know, good management can really help, but to run a prison as a for-profit operation seems crazy to me.
Me too.
But I do see that you could run it as a nonprofit. You pay good managers decent salaries, and they could do a good job.
Right.
Because, you know, to me, the incentives for a for-profit prison are totally wrong. You want to send people back to prison so you can make more money if you're a for-profit prison operator.
Right.
And so that's kind of where I was coming from.
But let me tell you, having been inside the nonprofit world, Louise and I started a community for abused kids in 1978, which is still running, and a school, you know, we started a little later on, which has now largely the program has shifted over to the school. It's 100school.org if you want to see it. And, you know, for kids with really bad ADHD and whatnot, and Asperger's and part of the autistic spectrum. And what I saw when I was in that industry and what we made the conscious decision not to do, our notion of what we were doing is that we would always create, we wanted our institution to just have a few houses. We have three houses for kids, and to be a model for other organizations. So we can say, here's how to do it. Everybody please imitate us. But there were people in that industry, as it were, in the child care business, which was entirely not for profits. You couldn't be licensed by the state of New Hampshire if you were a for-profit. So it's entirely nonprofit. There were people in those nonprofits who were basically building empires and, you know, making their institutions larger and larger and taking larger and larger paychecks as their budget of their organization went past $1 million, past $2 million, past $3 million. And so empire building is not just limited to the for-profit world. There is a point where institutions should be answerable to the voters, and voters don't select nonprofits. They don't select the members of the board of directors of nonprofits, whereas voters do select, arguably, the board of directors for things like prisons, because that board of directors is your legislature. Am I making sense here?
Sure.
Okay.
I'm with you.
So I would be, I understand your logic, and I don't disagree with it. But I do think that there are some areas, and I think that prisons and schools are, you know, fall into those categories where we need really good oversight and good management. And there are some scandalous, badly run schools and prisons in the United States. But that should be the province of we the people. That should be, you know, it's the voters who should be doing that, not even a not-for-profit.
Well, maybe there's a new model that needs to be created. You know, a new corporate model or something that would.
Well, that's the cooperative movement, I think, is a good one. But running a prison as a co-op, I don't know. You know, it's because I'm thinking of Mondragon in Spain. You know, Louise and I went over and visited them. I wrote a chapter about it in my book Threshold, and they've become an empire. I mean, they're now a $50 billion a year company that has over 100 divisions in 70 or 80 countries, you know, with tens of thousands of employees, and they basically own the city of Mondragon now. And so, I mean, empire building is not limited to the for-profit world. But it's, you know, Randall, you raise a really interesting point, and it's one that I think that is deserving of a lot more discussion than it's getting in the public venue. Thank you for the call, and thanks for bringing it up. Jack in Denver. Hey, Jack, thanks for listening to AM760. What's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking the call. Say a strong supporter of Bernie. I signed his petition a couple weeks ago, and he's one of a few, Elizabeth Warren and himself, the politicians that I do donate to. And really appreciate your efforts on educating and motivating people, particularly on labor and economic issues.
Great.
I had just a couple quick questions, if I could.
Sure. Let me just, by the way, since you brought it up, mention that the petition asking Bernie to run for president as on the Democratic ticket in the Democratic primary is over at the Progressive Democrats for America website, which is pdamerica.org. Back to you, Jack.
Tom, were there ever laws on the books? My understanding is there was, but I don't know where they were, and I've tried to research it. Where for-profit health care in this country was illegal.
Yes. Yes. When I was growing up in Michigan, the Michigan Insurance Bureau, I don't know if it was law or if it was just the policy of the insurance regulators, but they did not allow for-profit. You know, Blue Cross Blue Shield was not non-for-profit, you know, and all the other insurance providers were not-for-profit. And all the hospitals were not-for-profit.
I understood that. So
I think it all changed in the 80s.
Yes, and so I wondered, you would think that that had to be as a matter of policy that was regulated and deregulated, otherwise for them to do that in unison the way they did.
Yeah, I think it all came about as a consequence of the Reagan era. You know, we really had this shift of thinking government is bad and corporations are good. And prior to Reagan, everybody understood that, you know, what corrupts government is big money and concentrated power. And after Reagan, everybody thought what corrupts government are minorities asking for a handout.
True.
That's what it came down to. And that's the Republican mantra to this day, is it's not the Koch brothers who are corrupting our government. It's black people in the inner city.
Mm. Pretty interesting stuff. Say the initial convention and going back to the Iraq thing, if Saddam didn't have a plan for a program, what was he doing with 500 metric tons of yellowcake uranium? It was stored around Basra and sold about 2 years after our occupation to Canada to one of their nuclear plants, I believe, and maybe two of them. I think it went to Montreal.
Yeah, I believe you are wrong.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
No, there were never any weapons of mass destruction found, Saddam. You know, it just was not in that business. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, Paul Ryan, back to your calls in just a second here, but Paul Ryan says, we have in our inner cities, his phrase, we are dealing with, quote, a real culture problem in those communities. He says, quote, we have got this tailspin of culture in our inner cities in particular of men not working and just generations of men not even thinking about working or learning the value and the culture of work. So there's a real culture problem here that has to be dealt with. Now, why would he talk like that? Back in 1981, after Lee Atwater helped run Ronald Reagan's campaign for president, Lee Atwater was interviewed by Alexander Lemus, and a recording of that interview ended up in the hands of Jimmy Carter's son, James Earl Carter, grandson, yeah, James Earl Carter IV. And The Nation magazine published it. And what Lee Atwater said was, and I'm going to tell you what he said, and then I'm going to play it for you. You can actually hear him say it, but it's a little hard to hear some of it, so I'm going to tell you first. He says, you start out in 1954 by saying, and he actually uses the N-word, but N-word, and we've bleeped that, but you'll hear it. He says, by 1968, you can't say N-word. That hurts you. It backfires. So you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. And you're getting so abstract. Now you're talking about cutting taxes and all these things. You're talking about our totally economic things, and a byproduct of them is blacks get hurt worse than whites. We want to cut this, you know, Republicans should say it that way. We want to cut this is much more abstract than even the busing thing, and a hell of a lot more abstract than N-word. You didn't bleep the last two? Okay, you could just cut it before we get to the last two, okay? We'll just stop right there after he says a hell of a lot more abstract than. Here is Lee Atwater.
You start out in 1954 by saying by 1968 you can't say that hurts or backfire, so you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. And you get it so abstract now, you're talking about cutting taxes and all of these things you're talking about are totally economic things, and the byproduct of them is blacks get hurt worse than whites. And subconsciously, maybe that is part of it. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that if it is getting that abstract and that coded, that we're doing away with the racial problem one way or the other. You follow me?
obviously sitting around saying, we want to cut taxes, we want to cut this, and we want is much more abstract than
the than even the busing thing, and a hell of a lot more abstract than saying N-word. This is Lee Atwater laying out the strategy in 1981. Paul Ryan fulfilling the strategy right now. Here's another example. Back in 1980, another guy who worked on Ronald Reagan's campaign, Paul Wehrick, who went on to co-found the American Legislative Exchange Council. ALEC was one of the guys who helped pull together the Heritage Foundation and several other of these right-wing think tanks, worked on every Republican presidential campaign right up to and including George W. Bush. He's now deceased. But he was one of the he was the guy who ran the direct mail operation in Reagan's campaign in 1980. And back then, direct mail was what the internet is today. He raised the money. He made it possible. He made it work for Ronald Reagan. This is Paul Wehrick speaking to a group of Republican Christian activists in a church basement in Dallas, Texas, in 1980. Here he is.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome, good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
There you go. I mean, it's right there. And to take this back to Paul Ryan, what is Scott Walker doing in Wisconsin right now? Cutting early voting. I mean, and not just in Wisconsin. You got, you know, some 15, 20 states where Republicans are aggressively making it harder for people to vote. 1980 has come to roost in 2014. These guys are playing from the exact same playbook they have been playing from since 1980. And there you hear it in their own words. And I just want that to be on the record, to quote John Kennedy, to paraphrase John Kennedy from the 1960 Nixon-Kennedy debates, where he says, Mr. Nixon constantly misstates my opinions, as is his right, but I just want to have it on the record. This is where he said that he was going to actually increase the amount of taxes paid by rich people by closing loopholes, and he was going to use that money to have more, you know, more money spent on education and those kind of things. You've heard me play that clip. I won't do that. It's Anything Goes Friday, so let's get back to your calls here. Lori in Mashpee, Massachusetts. Hey, Lori.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
I am well. Awesome. You wanted to talk about Paul Ryan?
Yes. Just for clarification, if I may, I've recently moved from Mashpee, Massachusetts, home of Elizabeth Warren, to Florida.
Oh, well, you need to let Danielle know so she can change our database, because when you called, it recognized you from your old, wherever you used to live, so.
I realize that probably happened, and it's a different world down here than it was in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
Totally different world. We are back in the 1980s. Nothing has changed here.
Wow.
But getting back to Paul Ryan, if I may, the culture of work and not valuing the culture of work. I know that one of your recent callers said that she lived in Texas and she taught inner city kids. They were all really intelligent. She really thought that it was just, she didn't like the way inner city kids were portrayed, and she countered that. But I think Paul Ryan is right, because you said he lives in D.C. The average income is $250,000 plus. The average apartment is $3,000 a month plus. And that's typical. So gentrification has been fulfilled. Paul Ryan is talking about his inner city, and the people there have no culture of work. They really have a very bad work ethic. And I think with the removal of the inheritance tax, generations of males in Washington, D.C. have literally become the Paul Ryans of the world. And I think he was talking about his own universe. That's kind of an Orwellian thought.
I suspect you're saying this tongue-in-cheek, right?
My tongue is sticking into my teeth.
Yeah, okay. Right.
But just the fact that it is true in his world that they really have no culture of work. Congress doesn't work. They don't go out and do the job of people's work.
Right.
They work with the money people. They don't do everything they expect everybody else in the inner city to do for next to nothing. They're the ones that are the non-producers and non-workers.
Oh, yeah. And let me, apropos of what you're saying, if I may, Governor Robert Bentley in Alabama, John Archibald was writing about this. And this, he just gave his State of the State address, apparently, a week or two ago. And he said, and I quote, "We will never see an end to the plague of poverty by offering a deeper dependence on a flawed government system. We will never help our poorest citizens or our future generations by casting over them the net of government giveaway programs. We can break the cycle of poverty, but not with programs that drag our communities and our people into the downward spiral of dependence. There is never freedom for the breadwinner who is dependent on the government." End of quote. And then he went on to talk about how wonderful things are in Alabama. And he said 1,000 Alabamians are finding opportunity in Mobile, where Airbus has invested $600 million. What he didn't say is that the government of Alabama has put up so much money for this that it's costing the citizens of Alabama $159,000 for every single Airbus job. He went on to brag about how 900 more people are working this year assembling Montgomery, Alabama-made Hyundai vehicles. He didn't point out the fact that he gave $250 million, $250 million in incentives to Hyundai. And he also gave Mercedes $250 million, and he gave $158 million to Honda. And in fact, AIG, Chrysler, GM, and the nation's largest banks, just them, in federal corporate welfare, have taken $27 billion. So here you've got this governor saying, government giving money to people is a terrible thing. It makes them dependent. Oh, by the way, here, have some more money, Hyundai. Here, have some more money, Mercedes. Have some more money, Honda. To your point, Lori, I think very well said. Thank you for the call, and thank you for giving me an opportunity to rant on that. Richard in Evanston, Illinois. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Oh, hi. I think Good Jobs First, by the way, on that last topic, has the top 100 moochers, and the Koch brothers got $88 million. Warren Buffett got $1 billion of our money, and
wow.
It's on and on. And I tried to get this. I tried to go to our state legislature to get some of that information. You can't find it. At least I couldn't, because I said, "Well, I'd like to tell everybody in the state how you're giving your money away. You must be proud of it, and I'll help you publicize it." But couldn't get the info. Hey, yep. The reason I got on was your segue with that guy down at Atwater. And I don't think the only disagreement I have is I would not have edited out the words because the words.
I just can't play them on the air. I mean, it's just.
Yeah, I understand. I understand. I'm sorry. But here's the thing. You know, I've got this theory. How do things change? And I've got this idea that the only way is if more and more people voted. And this has been a topic for many years, but you never see a national movement, at least from the parties, because I think they like having limited voting because they can craft their message so well.
Right.
But imagine the changes if 70% voted. Nobody, the media or the donors or both political parties for that matter, would know what to do.
Oh, yeah.
How could you do this messaging? And we need to do that because the Democrats maybe finally now will be for it because they know that if everybody votes, they're going to do well. So
I agree. I absolutely agree. And look at Australia. I mean, 98% election. But it's because, hang on just a second.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's because in Australia, if you don't vote, you essentially get a traffic ticket. You know, you get a fine. It goes up over elections. Richard, thank you for the call. We'll be back. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Jesse watching Free Speech TV in Miami, Florida. Hey, Jesse.
Hey, hi, Tom.
How's the weather down there? It's got to be beautiful.
Hey, I should pick you to be the FCC man for Bernie Sanders.
I would take it. Although I'd rather be on the Supreme Court, but you know, then you get to be king, right? So you have ideas to get Bernie to run for president?
Now. Huh?
You said you have ideas to get Bernie to run for president?
Yeah, sustainable ideas.
Okay.
Number one. Cooperatives. I think most people support that to be equal partners instead of one boss. That would be more compatible with democracy. The second one is public banks. It's time we get a mortgage where we could give ourselves a break on a mortgage. We don't have to spend 30 years paying three times the price of a house. I think we would give ourselves a better deal if we control the money. The third is community land trust, ill estates, whereas the land is owned by the people. We could get rid of speculators. Mm-hmm. So what you think?
Yeah, I like them all.
So I think Bernie could free the 99% with these ideas the way Lincoln freed the slaves.
I don't disagree, and I think that these are all things that Bernie would agree with, and I think that they are probably all things that in the past he has said he agrees with, although I'm very wary about speaking on his behalf, and sometimes my memory is imperfect as to what he has exactly said or not. But these are ideas that are certainly in the spirit of democratic socialism, which is what Bernie represents so well. Jesse, thank you very much. Collins in Windsor, Colorado, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Collins, what's up?
Well, how are you? Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
You know, I watch you often and I listen often, and I guess I'm just amazed at, you know, we talk about we need to be educated and get out there and vote and get people active. But what kills me is just how naive we are. And give me your take. Why is it that the Republicans and the conservatives can just scream from the highest hill all these lies and get away with it? Don't we own the
because
airwaves?
Because David Gregory will put them on Meet the Press. You know, I was was it this morning or yesterday? I was watching MSNBC and David Gregory is being interviewed, and the guy says, "Oh, and what's coming up on Sunday?" And I said to the TV, "It's Sunday. It's Republicans." And David Gregory says, "Oh, we're going to have the Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee on." And I'm like, "See, told you so." So, yeah, the Republicans overwhelmingly are overrepresented on the Sunday talk shows. They're overwhelmingly overrepresented on all news broadcasts. They've got a nationwide network of right-wing talk radio to echo their message. And then they've got an entire television and radio network in Fox News, or television network anyway. I think they also produce radio newscasts. And it's all there. And then there's this huge money network of that supports anybody on the right who is either in talk radio or is a good speaker or is a good writer. They'll you write a book, a good right wing book, and bang, instantly. I mean, even if you're Jerome Corsi, they will sell enough. And he's the guy who wrote Swiftboat Veterans, for Truth. You write a book, they will buy 10,000 copies and pop you to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. It's become part of the business model of Simon & Schuster to find conservatives who, it's nuts. It's nuts. That's what's going on, Collins. Thanks for the call. But that's how we're getting duped. We'll be back. Welcome back, and it goes Friday, although let's get into the news here for a moment. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, is on the line. Hello, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
Happy Friday to you.
And to you, too.
Well, thank you. What's going on in the world?
President Obama, as we speak, is meeting with Internet CEOs, Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, head of Yahoo, Google, Dropbox, Netflix, people, those CEOs and others, many others in the Oval Office to talk about privacy, NSA surveillance and those related issues. And they're not happy. They're not happy because of the privacy issue. They're not happy because of the surveillance issue. They're also not happy because of the bottom line issue. Microsoft has lost customers, including the government of Brazil. IBM is spending more than $1 billion to build data centers overseas to reassure foreign customers that their info is safe from prying eyes in the U.S. government.
Wow.
Meantime, Wednesday, the NSA's general counsel told the government oversight group that these companies were fully aware of the NSA's collection of information under Section 702, the FISA Amendments Act. Now, the companies say, oh, no, we weren't.
So really what they're saying, if we're to believe the NSA, which is, a huge caveat, what they're really saying is we're not upset that you did it. We're upset that Ed Snowden leaked it and people found out you did it and that, and this is hurting us. I'm wondering if is the issue of net neutrality and the D.C. Circuit Court striking that down and the ability of the FCC to put it back into place by simply saying that ISPs are common carriers and they're regulated under the common carrier provisions, a stroke of the pen, literally, by Tom Wheeler. Is that going to be part of this conversation in the Oval Office?
I don't know. It's not been mentioned in any of the readouts that I've heard. It wouldn't it wouldn't surprise me if it comes up.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, Comcast, AT&T, and, you know, the who are the other companies that are the big ISPs, Verizon, are not in the room, are they?
Yeah. No, those are not there. They're not the ones. This is the tech company.
Right. So these are the companies that are content providers. They're the ones that actually are hurt by a loss of net neutrality.
Right.
In fact, the CEO of Netflix spoke out on this either the day before yesterday or the day before that. And I thought it was just a wildly underreported story that he came right out and said this, you know, that this is, we need to have net neutrality back. We're already paying Comcast now to deliver our signal, and it's wrong. It shouldn't be.
Bloomberg, I believe, is reporting about this.
Yes, that is probably where I read it.
Yes. Also today, staying with surveillance, the judge who presides over the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court is chiding the Justice Department for failing to reveal to the court that litigants in at least two lawsuits over NSA spying believed that outstanding orders from another court required the spy agency to keep phone call data indefinitely. Now, he says that the government, upon learning about this, should have made the FISC aware of the preservation orders and of the plaintiff's understanding of their scope, regardless of whether the plaintiffs had made a specific request. Not only did the government fail to do so, but the email correspondence suggests that the government sought to dissuade the plaintiff's counsel from immediately raising this issue with the FISC. Now, the judge acknowledged it was possible that the Department of Justice didn't do it intentionally, but it's pretty clear the judge doesn't believe them, it seems to me. But he says that the government lawyers have a heightened obligation to keep the court fully apprised, since it usually operates in secret and without the benefit of arguments or briefs from non-government lawyers. Now, this is particularly significant because he issued an order earlier this month rejecting the government's request to hang on to the phone metadata beyond the 5-year point. However, his order assumed that there were no pending orders on the point from other courts hearing lawsuits challenging the surveillance. And, of course, there were.
Wow. Is this going to lead, do you think, to a new church commission?
Well, it's interesting. There are members of the church commission, as you know, who would like one. I think probably not. It is at the end of next week, I believe, that we're going to hear from DNI James Clapper and Eric Holder on the revisions that they are going to make to surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that those will probably be embraced and played with and that will be the change that will be taken on.
Hmm.
And then, of course, Congress has got its own ideas. And if they don't feel, particularly in the House,
right.
And then Leahy in the Senate and some others, Wyden, people like that in the Senate, don't feel that the NSA is curbing itself,
right.
They are just going to cut them off.
Is Section 702 Section 702 of the Patriot Act?
This is Section 702, the FISA Amendments Act. This is the overseas collection of data.
Okay. All right. Foreign intelligence.
Vice President Biden today told healthcare workers that patience and empathy are required to deal with frustrated Obamacare enrollees. He said, "We didn't help you much at the front end here, man." He said the president and I were as frustrated as anyone you ever knew, and he recommended President Obama a sainthood because he maintained his patience through the early technical problems.
Wow.
But he said that it would be foolish to think enrolling would not be difficult for people who never, ever, ever had insurance.
Sure. Well, that makes sense.
I think seems pretty realistic.
Yeah.
President Obama heads on a major overseas trip next week to a summit in Europe. Then he meets the Pope. Then he heads to Saudi Arabia. He plans to use the trip to fortify U.S. relationships with key allies.
Step by step. Okay.
But Ukraine will overshadow everything.
I suspect. although things may have cooled down there. We'll see. Victoria Jones, Talk Radio News, goodsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us is Abraham Bolden, Sr., the first African-American Secret Service agent assigned to the Presidential Detail, the author of The Echo from Dealey Plaza. The website is echofromdealeyplaza.net. And Mr. Bolden, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Tom, and thanks for inviting me.
It is an honor and a privilege to speak with you, sir. You were, well, if you could tell your story to our audience.
Yes, well, I grew up in East St. Louis, Illinois, young man, and I went to Lincoln High School. And after I graduated from Lincoln University in Jefferson City, Missouri, I sought employment in the police line. Now, I became a Pinkerton National Detective Agent, and from there I went into the Illinois State Police. And after being on the Illinois State Police for around 4 years, I became a United States Secret Service Agent. Now, in being a United States Secret Service Agent, I was transferred here to Chicago, Illinois. We had a hot election going on at the time I was appointed a Secret Service agent under Eisenhower in 1960. We had Nixon and Kennedy battling toe-to-toe. And, of course, everyone knows, according to history, that Kennedy came out on top. Well, I was transferred to Chicago after having served on the state police in Peoria, Illinois. Now, President Kennedy, being a newly elected young president, energetic president, who had been very impressive in his debates with Nixon concerning especially civil rights issues. Now, the president was coming to Chicago on April the 28th of 1961 in order to thank Mayor Daley at a big banquet that they were having at McCormick Place in order to thank Mayor Daley for turning out the vote. Mm-hmm. I think he won Cook County by somewhere like 8,000 votes or so.
Uh-huh.
And Mayor Daley and his machine was directly responsible for his taking of Cook County, which put him over the electoral vote.
Mm-hmm.
So now, when the president was coming to Chicago, as I said, to thank Mayor Daley, and at me being a new agent in the Secret Service office assigned to Chicago, having been appointed in Chicago October the 30th of 1960 under President Eisenhower, I was assigned to the lower level of Wacker Drive in front of a bathroom, in front of a toilet that was set aside for the president to use. Now, normally they would have had a uniformed policeman at that position. But they moved the uniformed policeman at that position and moved me downstairs at the position in front of the washroom.
And I think that I was very disappointed, I recall, because I wanted to see the president so bad because I thought so much of him and his policies and programs that he had promised the American people. He was very well liked in the so-called black neighborhoods at that time, and I think that he got a tremendous lift and vote from the political structure here that was being run largely by Negro politicians in Chicago here. Anyway, on April 28th of 1961, the president arrived a little late at McCormick Place, and I was stationed downstairs, as I say, in front of this washroom, and I heard the motorcade pull up at around 8:30. The president was due at 8 o'clock, but the motorcade was late. So when the motorcade pulled up, I saw the cameras flashing upstairs, and the newspaper photographers and everybody, they were scampering about and moving about and stumbling over each other, all trying to get in the best position to get a shot at the president. And I was straining my neck trying to look up those two flights of stairs so that I could at least get a vision of President Kennedy. Well, I got a big surprise that night because as I looked up about the second time straining my neck, the president was coming down the steps. The first thing that he wanted to do was use the washroom. So I was in the best position in the whole house.
Yeah.
As the president approached me with Mayor Daley and all of the high dignitaries of the Democratic Party of Cook County, so it really worked to an advantage to me. But more surprising than anything else was the fact that as the president, before he entered the washroom, he stopped right in front of me. Well, I had no idea what was on his mind, so I kind of stepped to the side, and the president stepped to the side and kept facing me. So he looked at me and asked me, he said, "Are you a Secret Service agent or are you one of Mayor Daley's finest?" And I responded, "I'm a Secret Service agent, Mr. President." And one of the agents who had accompanied the president downstairs told him my name, said, "That's Abraham Boland. He's stationed here in Chicago." And the president looked me right in the eye and he smiled. He said, "Mr. Boland," and that's what he called me. He said, "Mr. Boland, has there ever been a Negro on the White House detail, security detail of the Secret Service?" And I looked at him. I was surprised that he asked me that. I said, "Not to my knowledge, Mr. President." And he looked me straight in the eye and he looked around. He smiled at Mayor Daley and William Dawson, who was congressman from the south side of Chicago, a very powerful politician. They smiled, and he looked me in the eye and said, "Would you like to be the first?" I said, "Yes, sir, Mr. President." I almost fell backwards. And so he said, "I'll be looking forward to seeing you in Washington, D.C. soon." And so I came home. You know, I was very enthused. It was a remarkable thing that had just happened to me. I never in 1,000 years, when I was watching a president on television doing his debate with Richard Nixon, I never thought that I would be standing face to face with the president of the United States, especially. It was a great honor for me to have had that conversation. If it had stopped at that, that would have been a great accomplishment for me. But to be invited to Washington, D.C., to become the first African-American to be assigned to the White House Secret Service detail was like adding icing on the cake. This was really something that I had never expected. Well, on June the 6th of 1961, I reported to Washington, D.C., and became the first African-American assigned to the White House detail. Now, immediately after assuming a position on the White House detail, I noticed that there was a laxity around the president. There were a lot of misconduct things going on among the Secret Service agents. Many of them would leave the White House during the lunch period, and they would go to different bars and have martinis, and they would come back in no condition to protect the president of the United States. And I noticed that this was a real problem because the supervisors were doing nothing about it. And the agents, they seemed to me to be overconfident. And when I brought this up to the chief of the Secret Service, he says, well, it seems like, you know, you're a new agent and blah, blah, blah. He made excuses for him instead of paying me any real attention. Now, that was James Riley, the chief of the United States Secret Service detail.
If I may, we're talking with Abraham Bolden, Sr., the first African-American Secret Service agent assigned to the presidential detail, who got himself caught up in something really nasty after he was assigned to be the first African-American to serve the president. We'll continue with this in just a second. The Echo from Dealey Plaza is the book. EchoFromDealeyPlaza.net, the website. Stick around. And Mr. Bolden, please hold on the line.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more of Abraham Bolden, and eventually Lamar Walden is going to join us as well. We'll be right back. So, Mr. Bolden, or Agent Bolden, what's the appropriate title, sir?
Yes, Mr. Bolden is
okay.
Right.
So, Mr. Bolden, you were talking about how the Secret Service reacted to your pointing out that some of these agents, and we're going to have to take another one of these short breaks like this in about 4.5 minutes, just as an FYI, and then Lamar will join us as well. Did that estrange you from the other Secret Service agents?
Yes, it did, because I became a constant complainer about some of the conduct that they were having, especially in Hyannisport, Massachusetts, when Kennedy went there for the 4th of July vacation.
Mm-hmm.
There was just too much drinking. Agents were reporting to the Kennedy compound in no condition whatsoever to go at the President of the United States. I found that there was a terrible amount of racism within the Secret Service. But the most astonishing thing to me was the fact that they were dead set against President Kennedy and his policies, and they had let that fact infiltrate their thinking as to their duties as a Secret Service agent. In other words, what I'm saying is that they had a personal dislike for the president, calling him such names as an N lover and speaking very disparagingly about the First Lady and much of the conduct of the president. Now, I thought that was horrible because we had a responsibility to protect the president and not to oversee his conduct. And so now I was personally called, as I said several times, the N-word, and I complained to my supervisor concerning the actions of the agents who were drinking and who were bringing in prostitutes to the hotel room where we were living. A little cottage, which was a little place just off from Hyannisport, Massachusetts. Now, when I came back to Washington, D.C., came back to Washington, D.C. on July the 5th, after the 4th of July holiday, I went straight into the chief of the United States Secret Service office, Ulysses S. Bauman. And I told Mr. Bauman that, as a fact, that the president, if anyone should take a shot at the president or try to harm the president, he would be in serious trouble because his Secret Service agents that surrounded him were very racist and they were against his policies. And I had heard them with my own two eyes, ears make the statement that if one should try to harm the president, that they would stand down. That he would not protect the president because he should get what's coming to him. Now, I thought under the circumstances that this was such a horrendous statement that was made by one of the supervisors, Harvey Henderson, of the Secret Service, that it should be brought directly to the attention of the chief of the United States Secret Service, which I did. Now, them having that attitude, the agents surrounding the president having that attitude, I asked to be relieved of my duties on the detail and came back to Chicago, Illinois, where I became a field agent again. But
okay. Let's pick up the story in just a second. We have to bounce out for just a second here. We're talking with Abraham Bolden, Sr., Walker, the first African-American Secret Service agent assigned to the presidential detail. He's the author of The Echo from Dealey Plaza. The website is echofromdealeyplaza.net. And I believe Lamar Waldron is going to join us in just a moment, too. We'll be right back. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. We're talking with Abraham Bolden, the first African-American Secret Service officer to protect the President of the United States. He was assigned at John Kennedy's request to President Kennedy back in 1961, and or thereabouts. Correct me if I'm wrong, sir. And you were telling us how the agents, particularly in around Hyannis, were racist. They were calling you the N-word. They said that if somebody tried to attack the president, they would stand down because he was an N-word lover, and therefore they thought that he would just be getting what he deserved. You brought this to the head of the Secret Service, and that's where we stopped. You want to finish the story?
Yes. When I came back to Chicago, whenever anyone from Washington, D.C., any official, high official, would come through Chicago, and that there were many occasions, especially Inspector Kelly, whose jurisdiction covered the Chicago office, I explained to him what had happened and the attitude of the agents who were surrounding the president, that they would let the president be assassinated. Now, no one really wanted to pay me any attention here in Chicago. I brought it to the attention of my supervisors here in Chicago. And when President Kennedy came to Chicago in March of 1963, I noticed that the same conduct was endemic within the agents of the United States Secret Service who came from Washington, D.C. with the president. I understood from conversations that I overheard that they had been down on Rush Street, they were drinking all night, and they were in such a condition that they could not have possibly protected the president, because at a meeting that we had that were discussing the visit to Chicago in March of 1963, many of the agents were falling asleep. They were dozing off even during the meeting, when we were discussing his protection. Now, in the meantime, we had serious threats against the president's life. We had a threat that had developed in different locations. The president was to come to Chicago again for, I believe, was the Army Air Force football game. He was due to come here on November 2nd of 1963. Well, there was a lot of commotion because we had heard that there were men who had come to Chicago, Cubans, who were controlled by two European men who had lived in a rooming house just off of North Avenue and the Kennedy Expressway. They were in a rooming house, and the lady went into their room, and she saw, I don't know what were the circumstances that she saw them, but she saw high-powered rifles equipped with sights, and she also saw the itinerary. The motorcade, rather, the president was marked on one of the newspapers. So she put two and two together and notified the FBI. Well, the FBI, on November the 1st of 1963, called the Secret Service, and the Secret Service began an investigation into this. In the meantime, the agents who were investigating this and tried to detain and follow those suspects, they lost them. They blew the investigations. And now I believe that that was the reason that President Kennedy had to postpone his trip, because the fact that we had lost those.
Because there was a credible threat of an assassination. We
yes,
just have about
a very three, credible threat.
We just have, we, sir. We just have about 2.5 minutes left, and I'd like to get. I want to get to the end of the story. You tried to tell the Warren Commission that there had been a credible threat against the president in Chicago after the president was assassinated, and that led to your going to prison. Can you tell us how that happened?
Yes, that's right. Now, what happened was that we had an investigation here. We had an undercover agent within a group, and
he heard one of the leaders of the group say that the president was about to be assassinated. Well, when the actual assassination happened, and I saw them gathering up the files and changing dates on the in the file, and heard Mr. Martineau, who was the special agent in charge, changing dates and retyping files and things like that, I knew that there was a cover-up going on. And I knew that the Warren Commission was not getting this information because none of these characters who had foreknowledge that the president was going to be assassinated were being called before the Warren Commission. And so now I thought it was a horrendous act that the agency was doing, and I thought that I owed it to the American people to try to get before the Warren Commission and clarify much of the information that we had about the assassins here in Chicago and arrests that we had made and information that we had obtained. However, when I went to Washington, D.C. on May the 17th of 1964, they brought me back, the United States Secret Service brought me back, told me that there was an investigation going on back in Chicago, a counterfeit investigation that I was needed for. Now, I had tried to contact J. Lee Rankin, who was the general counsel for the Warren Commission, and there was another agent with me, and I believed that I was being followed, and that telephone the call that I tried to make to J. Lee Rankin to the White House had actually been recorded or something had happened. But anyway, early the next morning, the supervisors and the chief of the United States Secret Service took me to Dulles Airport and brought me back to Chicago, Illinois, where I was charged with a crime. I was charged with soliciting a bribe from two counterfeiters, both of whom I had arrested.
Amazing. Mr. Bolden, can you stay with us for the rest of the hour, sir?
Yes, I can.
Great. We have to take a break for the news here at the bottom of the hour. It's about a five-minute break. We will be back with Abraham Bolden Sr., and then a little later on, Lamar Waldron is going to join us as well. Echo from DealeyPlaza.net is the website.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And Lamar's website is thehiddenhistoryofthejfkassassination.com. We're going to have Agent Bolden, Mr. Bolden, finish his story right after the news. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Danielle, for some reason, when I click on Abraham Bolden's line, it doesn't. Oh, there it goes. Okay.
I'm here. Working.
Ah, Mr. Bolden, welcome back. Yeah. So if I can recap very quickly, and please correct me if I get any of these details wrong, you were a Secret Service agent. You were in Chicago. President Kennedy came through. He met you where you were assigned to guard a washroom that he would use. He invited you to come to Washington, D.C. and be the first African-American Secret Service officer or agent as a member of the presidential security detail. You found that there was extraordinary racism and a lot of drunkenness and carousing with prostitutes and whatnot among that group, particularly in Massachusetts or when they went to Hyannis, and that they disliked Mr. Kennedy, President Kennedy. They called him an N-word lover. They said that if somebody were to shoot him, he would simply be getting what he deserved. You reported this to the head of the Secret Service, which did not earn any friendship from them. So you ultimately said, just send me back to Chicago. You were back in Chicago, and you discovered, it was known to everybody in the Secret Service, apparently, that there was a real credible threat with two guys with high-powered rifles who were going to shoot the president's motorcade on the 2nd of November of 1963. This is just a few weeks before he was assassinated in Dallas. After he was assassinated, the head of the Chicago Secret Service office and some of these other officers were retyping these reports and changing the dates and obscuring the facts. You wanted to get the information of the Warren Commission. You went to Washington, D.C. to do that, and they sent you back to Chicago where you were arrested for taking a bribe from two guys that you had arrested previously, two counterfeiters. Are we up to speed so far?
You're absolutely right.
Okay.
You're absolutely right.
So it turns out that you were set up for this arrest. You did not take a bribe from these men. Why did they set you up? Why did you spend the next, I believe it was 7 years in prison? And what, you know, tell us the rest of the story here.
Well, the reason that was given by Inspector McCann, who accompanied me back to Chicago on the flight, TWA flight, he said that I was not a team player and that the members of the Secret Service, the echelon, were not going to stand by and see me wreck their careers. This is what he told me during the conversation that I had with him. So I have no question that this whole thing was formulated because of my intent on going before the Warren Commission. Now, the person, one of the persons who testified in my trial, a guy named Joseph Spagnoli, was a runner and really a flunky for Sam DiStefano. Now, Spagnoli subsequently, after I was convicted in January of 1965, Spagnoli confessed that he received information from the U.S. Secret Service and the U.S. Attorney General's office that as to what to say in my trial. And he admitted that he had perjured himself, and he also produced copies. Now, the reason he said that he had done that is because that the Secret Service and the U.S. Attorney Richard Seitz had solicited him to do that. Now, this other person who testified against me was Frank Jones. He was going down on my testimony for the third time. He would have been convicted on a third-time felony, which carried a life imprisonment sentence automatic in the state of Illinois. Now, these are the two people that testified in my trial. Not only that, we had information that, as I say, an undercover agent who was very reliable and who had heard one of the conspirators here in Chicago said that the president was about to be assassinated. Now, that conversation took place about 2 weeks before the actual assassination. Now, so what that brings us to is this, is that we had forehand knowledge that the president was about to be assassinated. We knew the reason that was given that the president was going to be assassinated, and the reason that was given by this Cuban exile was the fact that LBJ would be more agreeable for the Cubans to go back in and try to take Cuba, and that they had finally gotten the money. The Jews had put up money in order to finance the going back into Cuba and taking over Cuba by the mob. So the mob had a connection, had a very serious connection with the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. So now what they did with me, the judge, after the judge had told the jury to find me guilty in one trial and then listen to the second trial and expel me out of the courtroom, they sent me to a Springfield Medical Center for Federal Prisoners. Now, they sent me there with the intent of somewhere along the line of declaring me insane. I knew that up front, and I was prepared for it. And so on July the 6th of 1967, they came and got me out of the camp, which I was assigned to, took me over to the psychiatric ward and tried to declare me insane. They kept me there. They forced me to take psychotropic drugs and tried to their best to see that I never come out of that penitentiary. Now, the psychiatrist told me that when he interviewed me, that once that I came out of 2-1 East, which was the psychology division of Springfield Medical Center, that I wouldn't even know my name. But the thing about it is I defeated it. I defeated the medication with God's help, and I came through it, and I'm able to talk with you today as I did back in 2009, where we had a nice conversation, Tom, and I appreciate you inviting me on the show again.
Yeah. Well, thank you, sir. And so you were set up. Let me bring Lamar Waldron in here, if I may. Lamar, are you with us?
Yeah.
Lamar, you and I have had much more interaction with Mr. Bolden and helped, you know, write the story of how he was falsely accused and convicted and sent off to prison, basically to shut down the investigation into who killed Jack Kennedy. Do I have that right?
That's exactly right, Tom.
So you want to just make a brief point or ask, do you have a question for Mr. Bolden that might illuminate this?
Well, I think one important thing, one important point to make is Mr. Bolden has told you about the attempt to kill JFK in Chicago. That was 3 weeks before Dallas. And JFK, they didn't just cancel the motorcade at the last minute. It was a very important motorcade. They had to cancel the entire trip. And what I was able to do, you and I working together, and was to build on the work of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, who in the late 70s investigated a lot of this material. And we were able to take that material and do a lot of additional investigation to confirm not only did that occur, I mean, I even spoke to JFK's press secretary, Pierre Salinger, who told me they had to issue two different phony excuses in the space of 45 minutes to explain why JFK canceled that Chicago trip at the very last minute without telling the public it was due to an assassination attempt. Not only did that happen in Chicago, but in Tampa, Florida, you and I also discovered by going through all of these old newspaper files that I was able to follow up with the Tampa chief of police that 4 days before Dallas, the same thing had almost happened in Tampa, Florida, only JFK couldn't cancel that motorcade at the last minute for reasons I'll explain later. So we had to go through with that motorcade. So there were two very dangerous attempts to assassinate JFK in the weeks before Dallas. John and Robert Kennedy themselves, in addition to all the law enforcement, kept those out of the press. So you can start to see this is why the Secret Service, one big reason the Secret Service was so worried about Mr. Bolden telling this to the Warren Commission, because the Warren Commission was not told about those two attempts. They got a little information informally through newspaper accounts about the Chicago attempt, because a little bit did appear later.
Mr. Bolden, did you approach the Secret Service and say, I have information, or did they come to you and say, the Warren Commission, or did they come to you and say, can you tell us something?
No, I tried to contact the Warren Commission.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think it was a surprise to anybody because they knew how I had been complaining. And when they were retyping these reports and redictating them and changing dates, I think that I made a mistake in letting them know that I knew what was going on.
Uh-huh.
And so now that was a horrible mistake that I made. So once that I did that, they knew that by me being an inside man, an agent within the office, that what I would say would have a whole lot more credibility than just the average researcher, because I was actually there. I could tell the commission dates and times that these things were going on, who received the files, who retyped them, and how they were delivered to Washington, D.C., to Assistant Director Paul J. Paterny. So I had a lot of information concerning this, and not only that, how it was connected here in Chicago, how the mob was connected in Chicago through Sam DeStefano and through Richard Kane, who had been one of the sheriffs here in Chicago.
And through the mob.
Yeah. All mashed together here in Chicago, and that's why they had to cover a lot of this up.
Yeah. Mr. Bolden, we have to take another one of those very short breaks. We'll be right back with Abraham Bolden Sr. and Lamar Wall.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Mr. Bolden's book is Echo from Dealey Plaza, the website echofromdealeyplaza.net. Lamar's book is The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination, and that's the website.com. So, Mr. Bolden, when you contacted the Warren Commission, did they welcome you coming to D.C., or did you go to D.C. sort of to knock on their door?
Never had a chance to contact the Warren Commission, because when I made the telephone call, I had dialed the White House number. I don't recall the number right now. But I was in a telephone booth. The agent was standing in a telephone booth next to mine. It was a tandem
telephone booth, but I noticed that he wasn't dialing anything. And so I know that he was probably there to try to listen in on any conversation that I had. And when I mentioned the name J. Lee Rankin, and I noticed that this other agent was not talking to anybody, I hung up because I just felt that he was standing in the booth to try to verify what I had in mind, because I believe to my heart today that the Secret Service knew what I would do once that I got to Washington, D.C., and they were set for it, and they were already planning for my demise. When I went to Washington, D.C., they couldn't set it up with me in Chicago because they know I would become aware of it. They had to wait until I was in Washington, D.C. for that weekend between May 15th and May 17th in order to get this thing all set up.
So
Tom, if I could add something else here.
Certainly, Laura.
It was even worse for the Secret Service than what has been explained so far. One reason the Secret Service, another reason, they were so worried that Mr. Bolden would not only tell the Warren Commission about the Chicago and Tampa attempts that were being completely hidden from the Warren Commission, but the night before JFK was shot in Dallas, I should actually say the morning JFK was shot in Dallas, there were, I believe it was between 6 and 9 Secret Service agents were in a sleazy after-hours club in Fort Worth. This is JFK's presidential protection detail, drinking high-alcohol drinks in a sleazy coffee shop that was serving these high-alcohol drinks served by scantily clad women. These were JFK's Secret Service agents who were supposed to protect him. They were in that club, some of them, till 2, 3, 4, even 5 a.m., before they had to report for duty at 8 a.m., and the public did not know that at the time. If the public knew that a lot of these Secret Service agents, many of whom you've seen on TV during this past 50th anniversary, were out drinking in a sleazy club owned by one of Jack Ruby's friends until, like say, one didn't leave that club until 5 a.m., had to report to protect JFK 3 hours later, that would have been...
It would have been bad news. Mr. Bolden, was that kind of conduct that Lamar just described in Dallas or in Fort Worth, was that consistent with the kind of conduct of the Secret Service officers that you saw or agents that you saw in Massachusetts who were protecting the president?
Absolutely consistent. Yes, it was. As a matter of fact, as I said, in March of 1963, when the president was coming to Chicago, the same type of conduct happened here in Chicago. And so by the agents who were to accompany the president. Now, this was in March of 1963. And so I complained about it then. And as I said, agents who were to protect the president, who had come here from Washington, D.C., were going to sleep in a meeting when we were discussing the protective assignment. They were actually going to sleep and bragging about it.
Because they'd been up all night drinking. We'll be right back. Abraham Bolden, Sr. and Lamar Wallace. Welcome back. We are witnesses to an extraordinary moment in history. Abraham Bolden, the first African-American Secret Service agent assigned to the presidential detail by Jack Kennedy himself, by President Kennedy, and who served the president, is on the line with us telling the story of how he got set up, because he tried to tell the story of an assassination attempt against the president just a few weeks before the president was actually shot. And Mr. Bolden, before Lamar and you wrap this thing up, this is, you know, maybe way off base, but do you think it's possible that in today's Secret Service there are agents who dislike the fact that they are serving and protecting an African-American president?
I have no doubt that there are. There are, and as you can see from some of the reports that we have received recently, just as recently as last year, the type of a conduct that I complained about all the way back in 1961 is still going on, as displayed in Colombia when the President Obama went to Colombia. The same type of conduct, the consorting with prostitutes and leaving their posts of duties and heavy drinking occurred there. And then I had other reports that when the president went on a vacation, President Obama, at Hannesport, Nantucket Sound down there, is that Secret Service agents were drunk again down there. So in my estimation, Tom, President Obama's in serious trouble so far as his security is concerned. And
wow.
Something should be done about it. The American people should write their congressmen and see that the Secret Service have taken steps to rectify many of the errors of conduct that were going on around the president. And I'm not sure that those faults have been corrected.
Yeah, that's a pretty startling thing to think about. Lamar, there is an effort that you and I, you know, we wrote about this for back in 2009 for Huffington Post. We should take this piece and reprint it. I think we could get it republished fairly quickly, to try to get Mr. Bolden a presidential pardon, because he was set up and the people who sent him to prison, you know, later admitted that they had lied and that he had, you know, basically it was trying to keep this information from the Warren Commission. How goes that?
Well, you're exactly right, Tom, and people can do two things if they'd like. They can go to the hidden history of the JFKassassination.com, and there is a link on that page. It's a very simple page. There's a link on that page that will take your listeners to the White House website, where I have established a petition calling on President Obama to grant both a presidential pardon and also to release all of the JFK assassination files, which according to NBC News may number up to a million pages. Also on that page, the hidden history of the JFKassassination.com, there is a link to that earlier Huffington Post piece that has a lot of detailed information. So if people want to tell their friends about Mr. Bolden's story, they don't even have to look at my book or his book. They can look at that link, and I will tonight update that story so we can get a more recent version. But so those two links are on that page as we speak.
Okay. And Mr. Bolden, your book, Echo from Dealey Plaza, and the website echofromdealeyplaza.net, when did your book come out, and how can people find it?
It came out in March of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's at the Amazon. It's at most of your bookstores. But if they would like an autographed copy, they can send me an email at a.bolden@sbcglobal.net. And the price is $15 plus $5 mailing fee.
Wow.
They can send it right to me, and I'll send them an autographed copy.
That's great. That's great. And the website is echofromdealeyplaza.net. Lamar, you want to wrap this up? We just have a minute or two.
One is, as Mr. Bolden has said, there have been all of these incidents in Columbia, in Miami. There was one at the Hay Adams Hotel in Washington, where this heavy drinking and carousing, you know, because Mr. Bolden's information was never made really public back in 64 in a wide way, you know, these behaviors have gone on. There's an ongoing racial discrimination lawsuit. I mean, somebody at a Secret Service training facility, an agent, found the noose on his desk. This goes back to 2008. And so you have racial discrimination that's still in the Secret Service today that's being fought by agents. So again, this is why it's important to get this information out. And then, of course, last but not least, the mafia could not afford to have the information about their attempts to kill JFK in Chicago and Tampa exposed back in 1964. That is why a closest mob associate of Sam DiStefano named Richard Kane, who was the number two man in the Cook County, Chicago Sheriff's Department, who was also a main member of the mafia, who had been working closely with mobsters on plots, like going back to try to assassinate Fidel Castro for the CIA back when Richard Nixon was vice president. Richard Kane is his half-brother, told you and I. He had the motive, means, and opportunity to have framed Mr. Bolden, to have helped arrange for that perjured testimony. And so the mafia and the Chicago mobster by the name of Johnny Roselli later admitted his role in JFK's assassination, as did the godfather of Tampa, Santo Trafficante, as did the godfather who controlled Dallas and Texas and all of Louisiana, Carlos Marcello. So as I explained in the hidden history of the JFK assassination, it's really clear now who killed JFK, which CIA assets they used. Of course, all of those three mob bosses I just named had also worked on those CIA mafia plots under Vice President Richard Nixon that started back in '60.
We have to wrap it up. Lamar Waldron, thank you for being with us. Mr. Bolden, it's an honor to have you on, sir. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for that. All right. Goodbye.
It's a true honor. Abraham Bolden, his website, echofromdealeyplaza.net. And, of course, the website for Lamar's book is The Hidden History of the JFK Assassination. And to all of you, thank you so much for being with us. And don't forget, democracy actually does begin with you. It requires you to show up. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active. And have a great week. See you on Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at tomhartman.com.